proceed to the second case of the day, the United States versus Vineyard. Mr. Leggins.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Tom Leggins, and I represent the United States in this direct appeal or alternatively petition for writ of mandamus. This case arose and it appeared to conclude relatively routinely. The defendant was charged shortly after his arrest. He was ordered detained. A few months later, he entered an open guilty plea. And then on May 3rd of last year, he appeared before the court for sentencing, where the district court imposed the mandatory 20-year sentence on the defendant. After that, things began to unravel. The day after the defendant was sentenced, the district court, sua sponte, without notice to the government and without a hearing, ordered the defendant released. We immediately appealed that decision, and this court immediately reversed or vacated the release order and ordered the defendant to be immediately detained.
The release order is one thing, but the judge having a change in heart and setting aside the plea, it was a pretty routine case. It would have been wrapped up in 30 days if the government hadn't appealed.
Well, the problem is...
And how was the government prejudiced by it?
I guess that gets into the question of the mandamus of irreparable harm. And it is our position that we are irreparably harmed in several ways in this case. One, a proceeding was had where after this court vacated the release order, it was remanded back to the district court, and then the district court not only ordered the defendant detained, but he also vacated the guilty plea. Mm-hmm. The district court vacated the sentencing, and the district court also discharged the defendant's counsel, all without notice, all without hearing, all without motion from the defendant. Now, that potentially could cause irreversible harm to the government first, because generally when a court vacates a guilty plea, in order to avoid double jeopardy concerns, the rules require that to be upon motion of the defendant. That didn't happen in this case, and it still hasn't happened in this case. So that's one basis of where the United States could suffer irreparable harm. Of course, we also suffer the harm of it, and what the district court did in this case undermines.
I just don't see how double jeopardy could be raised by the defendant as a
I don't know that it couldn't.
Here. I haven't seen anything that they were planning on doing anything like that, and it seems pretty
at this point,
meritless to make that happen.
We don't know what the defendant is going to do. And really, it's the sua sponte nature of everything the district court did that causes us concern. Because under the rules, as I understand them, jeopardy attaches upon the entry of a guilty plea. Now, when the jeopardy unattaches, for lack of a better word, under the law, as I understand it, when the defendant initiates a process for withdrawing the guilty plea, and that didn't happen here. We also suffer irreparable harm arising from the fact that we were deprived of our chance to make a record in this case. There's also irreparable harm arising from the fact that one of the factors that you look at... And
so what if you had notice, if you contested it and the judge allowed the defendant to vacate the plea, it's not an appealable order.
The trouble is that the judge did it after sentencing, and under the rules, there are time limits on when a district court can vacate a guilty plea. And after sentencing, according to Rule 11E, after the court imposes sentence, the defendant may not withdraw a plea of guilty, and the plea may only be set aside on direct appeal or collateral attack. So in this case, the district court allowed, or actually sua sponte, vacated the defendant's plea when under the rules, and which I think we are entitled to rely on, under Rule 11E, he could only do that, the defendant could only do that, on direct appeal or collateral attack. And the law is also clear, and we cited the cases in our brief, that a court may not sua sponte vacate a guilty plea after sentencing. And I think we cite four or five cases for that proposition.
Now, let me ask you a question, because Of course, you do have Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 33, and Rule 33 permits the district court within, you know, a seven-day period to grant a new trial after a judgment. And it doesn't say after a trial, a judgment produced after a trial, or a judgment produced after a trial with the court, or any other kind of judgment. It just says judgment. So my question was, in substance, is that a way that Judge Gilbert could have accomplished what it is he was trying to do? He had already accepted the guilty plea, so there was a conviction. He had already pronounced the sentence, so there was a judgment. But would Rule 33 have been a way? Of course, at that point, it would feed into the government's argument for appellate jurisdiction as opposed to mandamus under 3731. Because you're saying this is analogous to a grant of a new trial anyway. But I'm wondering if actually one pushed that a little bit further, whether it would in fact support what the judge did.
I don't believe so, and I believe it's based on the principle that if you have a specific provision that deals with the issues at hand, then that's the provision you apply. And we have Rule 11E, and we also have Rule 35 here, which deal with when the court can vacate a judgment or a may vacate a guilty plea, and when he can vacate a sentence. And when you have those specific provisions that apply, it would be our position that the more general Rule 33 provision would not be the applicable one for this court or the district court to be looking at.
In order to... Does Rule 33 have to be triggered by a motion by the defendant?
I don't believe so, but I must confess that I didn't look at it.
You do it sua sponte, you're saying.
If Rule 33 were applicable, but of course, as I just stated, it's our position that the more specific Rule 11E and Rule 35, which apply to this situation, would...
Rule 33 says that upon the defendant's motion.
Yeah.
So maybe you're giving away more than you mean to, but I'm not saying... A judge can't say, I'll entertain a motion and see if the defendant wants to do it. But this case is a little strange that the defendant has been so silent with respect to his preference. Maybe he doesn't want a new trial where he might get more than 240 months.
During the middle of the sentencing colloquy, the defendant started indicating that maybe he wanted to contest relevant conduct. At that point, the court called a recess, and all we have on this record is that the defendant, in fact, did want to proceed with his guilty plea, wanted to proceed with his sentencing. The defense counsel gave several good reasons for wanting that. As you just stated, there was a concern about losing the acceptance of responsibility points. In this case, those were worth 7.5 years to the defendant, assuming the court... would follow the advisory guidelines in this case. There was an agreement not to forfeit property that the defendant's wife and daughter were living in.
Probably has more teeth than the sentence, because certainly if you can infer anything from this record, it's that Judge Gilbert is not inclined to sentence Mr. Vineyard to anything higher than what the statute prescribes.
Although he has since recused himself from this case, so it is being handled by a different judge. So it's not necessarily – I mean, there is a possibility that if he loses his acceptance points, that the low end of his guideline range is going to be 324 months instead of 240.
So could I just ask you one other question on the appellate jurisdiction versus mandamus side of these things? I'm a little concerned about the argument for appellate jurisdiction only because this really, as you said a minute ago, doesn't fit the normal things in the statute. And even though the last paragraph of 3731 says this is to be construed liberally, more or less it says to permit appeals whenever the Constitution would allow it, is at least how I interpret it, still... this looks like a really bad fit for that. So from a mandamus point of view, do you think what Judge Gilbert did was really so far out of the ordinary proceedings of justice that we should intervene?
Yes, Judge, we do. In order to show an entitlement to mandamus, of course, the government has to show the violation of a clear legal duty and irreparable harm that cannot be redressed at a later time. As I previously stated, there are two clear legal duties that we believe the judge violated here. The first is Rule 11E, which states that after the court imposes sentence, the defendant may not withdraw a plea of guilty, and the plea may only be set aside on direct appeal and collateral attack. We also believe that the court violated the clear legal duty set forth in Rule 35A, which says that after imposition of sentence, that sentence may only be corrected for mathematical, technical, or other clear error. In this case, there's obviously been no allegation anywhere that this was a mathematical or technical error.
And no, so, is there anything actually other than just this theory that maybe even though there's a five-year period of time for challenging earlier convictions, somehow there'd be some way around that?
No, and in fact, the judge stated in one of his orders that the defendant is not likely to prevail on any of these arguments.
It sounded pretty weak to me, to be honest. But, I mean, they haven't been made yet, so I suppose I don't know what the record would be. But
yeah, and the errors the court identified were as why this might be clear error, or I guess why it might fit into the as something that the court would have discretion to do, was the 851 issue. But as Your Honor pointed out, convictions that are more than 5 years old, all you have to show is that they are represented by counsel. And the record is clear that this defendant was represented by counsel. Furthermore, the defendant admitted at sentencing, having sustained the conviction, that gave rise to the enhancement. And this court has previously stated that a ritual adherence to Section 851 is not required where the defendant is precluded from challenging his conviction.
I just can't understand why the government would have even appealed in this case. There's absolutely no prejudice to the government here. If this guy would have been ready to go to trial, and on the day of the trial, the government had 10 witnesses in the courtroom all ready to hear the case, and now he decides to change his plea, and you excuse all the witnesses, it changes his plea, and later the judge sets it aside. That's more of a difficult situation for the government to bring everybody back into court and so on. Here, I mean, just I know you disagree vigorously with what Judge Gilbert did here, but why do you want to waste your time appealing something like that?
Well, again, Judge, it goes back to our analysis of the irreparable harm. You know, I've already pointed out that the sua sponte nature of this, and I know you may vigorously disagree with that, could lead to double jeopardy concerns down the road. You have what several courts have identified as just the public interest in the finality and integrity of judicial proceedings. Also, the handling of the counsel issue in this case, which I haven't mentioned. This defendant's counsel was discharged without a hearing, without any inquiry of whether that was something the defendant wanted. And in my view, that potential Sixth Amendment violation could be a problem if we don't get this case back on track in a 2255. So for all of those reasons, I mean, the potential from the government standpoint, prejudice is that this thing is not final. And it's not going to be final until we can get it back on track. If the defendant wants to plead guilty, if the defendant wants to withdraw his plea of guilty, if he wants the counsel he had, all of those are questions.
Wait a minute. I thought what you were asking for in the mandamus was just to have the sentence, the plea and the sentence reinstated.
That is correct. That is correct, Judge.
And then if he wants to take an appeal and say there was something wrong with the way the guilty plea was done or the way the sentence was calculated, he can do that.
That is correct. But you would still have the issue relating to a discharge of his counsel.
Oh, sure. I mean, he might have a 2255 or some such thing. Yeah.
Again, I see I'm eating into my rebuttal time.
Just one question, Mr. Logan. Is part of your concern not just the reputable harm in this case, but the possible precedential value of allowing this course of conduct by a district judge in other cases. Is that part of the government's position?
Yes. I mean,
fear that it might happen.
Yes. I mean, I.
Is that part of your finality argument, I guess, is what I'm asking.
It's not part of my finality argument. I guess this is a situation that could arise again. So if
well, presumably that's one reason the Solicitor General authorized your appeal. You
correct.
Don't just take these appeals because
right.
you feel like it.
And certainly not a mandamus.
Right.
Yeah.
We don't. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Leggan. Mr. Gross.
May it please the Court, Mr. Leggans. We respectfully submit that we don't believe jurisdiction lies with this court on the direct appeal under 3771. Neither do we believe this is the type of case which you should consider mandamus as an alternative to direct appeal. The circumstances in this case are very unique.
Well, they are and they aren't. I mean, I guess that's why mandamus is something that we at least have to consider, because the rules are quite clear about the finality of the acceptance of a plea and a sentence and who is and how a defendant is allowed to complain. And presumably, most people follow those rules, and district courts don't have second thoughts about accepting a guilty plea that late in the day, or if they do, they let the system work. And when a district judge goes that far out of the ordinary operation, you have to ask, is there authority for the judge to do that somewhere? And if you can't find any authority for the judge to do it, then aren't we talking about something that's at least potentially a subject of mandamus?
Potentially.
So what authorized Judge Gilbert, in your view, 25 words or less, what authorized the course of conduct he took?
Either 35A or an inherent power under common law. I think every trial court judge has the right to make sure that a plea or court proceedings are just.
Why do you say that? I mean, because the rules themselves do say that if a defendant... there comes a point that if a defendant wants to complain about a guilty plea or a sentence, the way to do it is by filing an appeal. That's why we're here. And there are rules about how many days you have to go ask the district court to take another look at things, what kinds of arguments you're allowed to make. I'm not sure why we would even bother to have those rules if you could always just fall back and say, yeah, but in the end... we can disregard them and just ask the judge to fix things anyway.
Well, for instance, there's an older Illinois Supreme Court case, 1951, where after the judge took a plea, he had serious concerns about whether the man was sane, and vacated the plea and brought him back in and did a fitness examination. The Illinois Supreme Court and many jurisdictions, most of it consider the issue, say that a trial court judge, who's the man sitting there watching the proceedings, hearing the discussions, looking at the face of the defendant when these things are done, has to have some inherent power in his courtroom.
But that's certainly true while the case is there. But suppose a district court judge enters final judgment, fills out the form in the criminal matter, let's make it easy and assume it's a guilty plea. And then 4 months later, the judge wakes up in the middle of the night and thinks, boy, you know, I'm just really worried about Smith's case. And so I think I'm just going to reopen it and let the person come in and, if you will, make a competence argument, make an argument about amount of drugs, if that's what it is. We all agree. The judge just can't do that. I mean, we have rules about when the judge still has authority over a case and rules about when that authority is either passed on to another tribunal or the judgment is just final.
Well, Your Honor, I'd respectfully submit that if a court has the right to fix a mathematical error for 10 days, doesn't the court have a right to cure a violation of a defendant's constitutional right?
Well, why do you think the rule specified mathematical errors?
It
if that really meant you can fix anything in 10 days.
What does clear error mean? It's not a model of clarity, and I think the fact that there's some basis under 35A is enough to deny the mandamus. This isn't a case where, such as, you know, Spilatro, where, 284 days later, the judge, without any authority whatsoever, says the guy doesn't have to go to jail. This is more a situation where within a time period when he can do something, he, and with no prejudice to the government whatsoever.
But we don't reach prejudice unless we find a source of authority. And if you're really going to put your marbles in 35A, 35A allows correction of arithmetical, technical, or other clear error. Now, I'll grant you that last phrase is a little fuzzier than the first two, but you would at least, I think, have to look at this record and say that there was something that qualified as clear error before there would be 35A authority. Clear error with respect to the sentence, because 35A isn't about the guilty plea. 35A is about the sentence. What could possibly be clear error about imposing a mandatory minimum sentence that the judge has no authority to go below?
Well, I think the judge had concerns that he had not properly admonished the defendant under 851B.
But that doesn't affect the sentence at all.
Well, it in theory could. I mean, if he challenged the 850, if he filed an objection and challenged the enhancement and the judge removed the enhancement, and if he, or if he challenged his relevant conduct, which really seemed to be more of the issue with the defendant, and
how does that count as clear error? A clear error can't mean there is a 10% chance this might fly. And if you read Judge Gilbert's comments, he's, as I read him, is more saying there's a 10% chance this might fly. I know it's a long shot, but I mean, that, how is that clear error?
Whether or not the judge is right or wrong.
Well, no, answer my question. Why is it clear error to say there's a 10% chance this might work?
Well, I think it's clear error, and I mean in arguing clear error is that we've got a dead bang winner. I think what I'm saying with clear error is the judge felt that he had not done his job as a trial court judge, and he wanted to bring it.
Yeah, that's a much subtler point, though. I mean, in the case we just heard, it didn't really come out as much in the oral argument, but there was a mistake that the trial judge made by failing to notice that a sentencing guideline caps the offense level at a 29 at a certain point when you're working through the gun guidelines. All right, the judge didn't do that. That's going to, you know, the government conceded in its brief that that was a mistake. I would say that was a clear error. It resulted in the wrong guideline calculation for the sentence. Well, I don't see anything like that here.
Well, the defendant hasn't raised any errors at this point.
Yeah, where is the defendant's position? Has he filed anything indicating that he wanted his guilty plea set aside?
Not at the time that the trial court was divested of jurisdiction, because there's been an appeal,
right,
as the government's pointed out, in filing their motion to stay the proceedings that were going to be held back in June of last year. All the defendant's done since last June is sit in some subterranean county jail in Saline County, Illinois.
But, you know, in a lot of cases, Anders briefs that we get a lot of the time, one of the things we ask counsel to do is to consult with the client and say, are you interested in setting aside a guilty plea? Because we don't want counsel to explore problems in the Rule 11 colloquy if the person doesn't want to set aside the plea anyhow. So we get, there's a case called United States versus Knox that covers that. And so we get a lot of Anders briefs where the counsel represents, I've checked with my client. My client, in fact, does not want to set aside his guilty plea, so I haven't included anything in my Anders brief about the plea colloquy. And we accept that representation of counsel on appeal. So I just was wondering whether there is any glimmer of Mr. Vineyard's position here.
Well, I can, as he indicated in the sentencing transcript, which I'm sure you've all read, there was a big disagreement about the over 15 kilos and whether or not that made a difference. And Mr. Vineyard pointed out, and although I don't know if anybody was thinking about it at the time, these two confidential informants had placed 300 gallons of anhydrous on Mr. Vineyard, which is, I submit to court, and I don't know, meth is a thing that we deal with in southern Illinois all the time. 300 gallons in a tank, you'd have to have a crane. I mean, it's silly, and it's almost preposterous to think that a guy could have 300 gallons of anhydrous. Because and you probably all have the little cylinders at home for your barbecue grills that are 20-pound cylinders. They have about a gallon or two of LP gas in them. Well, it's the same type of thing. To have 300 gallons of anhydrous ammonia, you would have to have a tank that would be difficult to put in this room. So right off the bat, you have to question, does it make any difference?
But didn't he concede to the more than 500 grams, though, at that? And I thought that was about all that was necessary. The probation officer all of a sudden piped up and said, we still need the 15 kilos, but I thought he was wrong about that. I thought the 500 grams was enough.
Well, for guideline purposes, you know, the thing that raised his level, and this would all get into whether or not he would have any viability whatsoever in challenging under 851.
Though the old conviction is way more than 5 years old,
and if he has any challenge, it's a constitutional challenge that I don't think the court has really determined. Let's say his guideline range would have been 120 months, and because the relevant conduct wasn't high, and he didn't have a gun, he challenged some things that were the government had put on him, and the 851 doubled his sentence from the guidelines. The government's saying it doesn't matter because his guideline range is around 240 and the minimum's 240. And that's why the assistant U.S. attorney in this particular case kept spouting off, doesn't matter, Judge, doesn't matter. And it does matter if he challenges relevant conduct, lowers his relevant conduct, then mounts a challenge against the prior based on a constitutional argument. Now, as the judge said, I don't know if that's going to work.
What constitutional argument, other than no counsel, which is certainly not his case, have courts that you've looked at accepted? Certainly this court has only said if you were uncounseled in the earlier proceeding, then we'll allow you to get beyond that 5 years. But that's not Mr. Vineyard's situation. Is there any other constitutional failure in the earlier proceeding that we or anybody else you know has entertained?
No.
Okay. So no precedent at all?
No, but I don't think that would prohibit him from raising that type of a challenge if he...
It does tell you whether it's clear error or not, or whether it's something with any remote chance of success.
And, you know, getting back to the issue of clear error, and as this court has pointed out, Horak, I don't believe it matters if the judge is right or wrong. He probably, you know, maybe he was wrong. He says in his own order, maybe I was wrong, but isn't it better to give the defendant a chance to know what he's done? And if the defendant showed up in court that day and had never seen his pre-sentence report, never had a chance to make any type of objection, there's a lot of strange things about this case.
Well, there are, but, I mean, here's the problem. I think, again, we can make an argument straight from principles of justice and just saying, oh, you know, in this particular case, maybe following the rules is too picky and why worry about it. But there are institutional concerns for the courts about following the procedures and adhering to the right time when things are supposed to be made and finishing things up at the trial court level, letting them move on to the court of appeals level. And if district courts can just say, well, you know, I've thought better of it this time and I'm just not going to do it, it's disruptive.
I think it's worth it if you're protecting the defendant's rights. And had the government not appealed, this case would have been over a year ago, or at least in June of 2007, the defendant, or he would have got a right to a trial. And how is the government harmed? And
I think their answer is a more institutional harm. Sure, in any given case, maybe we should allow appeals to be filed 35 days after a district court judgment, not 30 days. There are some appeals that seem to cry out for attention, but if they're jurisdictionally late, they're jurisdictionally late. We don't hear them.
Well, again, I would rely on the Horak decision that says even if the judge was wrong, it's not grounds for mandamus, that he didn't violate a mandate of this court, and he didn't demonstrate a persistent disregard of federal rules. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gross. So, Leggins, your time had expired, but you had substantial questions. You may have an extra minute.
Let me go back to some of Judge Wood's questions.
Okay.
In one question, she said that the judge is now 40 days have passed and worried about Mr. Smith's case, so wants to undo everything. This case is 3 days, not 40. The judge here could have done what he did and could do it in any case if he were to say, all right, I've heard everybody. The sentence in this case is going to be 240 months, but it's conditional. I'm going to think about it for a week, and then I'll enter the judgment a week from now. Court's adjourned and left. Right? That would not have been an appealable order.
There is a case that we cite in our brief, I believe, called Patterson, that deals with it's either Patterson or Cannon. I'm sorry, Judge, but it deals with that fact pattern.
Judge can, first of all, delay, doesn't have to accept a guilty plea, can take it conditionally, and can listen to a sentencing proceeding and say, yeah, looks like it's going to be 240 months, but I want to think about it for a while. So it's conditional. Anybody want to say anything anymore? Nobody has anything to say. And a week later, the judge enters the judgment order. Might be, I'm not sure. 240 months maybe isn't the right sentence in this case. So bring everybody back in. To me, that is more cumbersome procedure, but I think you could do it.
You may be able to do it. I guess the triggering event in this case was that once this defendant is sentenced, the rules align such that a court cannot sua sponte revisit that. And I'd also point out that the errors that are being pointed out here, or the errors that the court identified, all related to sentencing. It was 851, and it was relevant conduct. And there is no basis for vacating the guilty plea. I mean, those are two separate issues. And the last point I would make, since I see my time has expired, there is a definition of clear error. It's at page 30 in our brief. We cite five cases in support. And it's basically is an error that would almost certainly require a remand. And it is our position that the violations in this case wouldn't have, and the court overstepped its authority. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gross. Mr. Gross, you have an additional thanks to the court for accepting the appointment in this case.